and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Chris, no middle initial, Webb Esquire, and with me is Robert Johnson.
Hello.
Hiya, how are you?
I am excellent.
Oh, that's good to hear, because it is Easter Saturday. We're recording this in the middle of the Easter weekend, so I think we're going to have an excellent adventure today, aren't we?
You beat me to the pun.
When you went to the toilet, I read your notes. How are you doing? You all right?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Well, actually, I'm struggling through a cold. I've hurt my back, but, you know, so I'm extra nasal today, listeners.
So the more astute listeners might realise that Rob isn't in Wellington. We announced last time he'd be in Wellington for future recordings. Because it's the Easter weekend, Rob's come back, and we're in Web Towers recording this today, but future ones probably will try and do a bit of Skyping.
Yeah, we're going to have to learn the technology.
I bought a headset.
Oh,
so I started.
Yeah.
We probably have to learn not to interrupt each other when we're talking. That's going to be the really difficult bit.
We won't have the visual cues,
no.
Which we still ignore anyway.
Yeah. So, it's your choice today. And if people haven't guessed already, what are we going for today?
Well, I have gone with a film which I first saw when it came out as a new release. And I must have been about 8 or 9 years old. 1989 film. And I remember, if I really liked a new release, I'd always watch it the next morning, because, you know, you had to take it back by 12:30.
Oh, yeah.
The next day, and you know, Mum and Dad had spent $7 on this. Wasn't like a five weeklies for $10 deal, you know, this was $7 for one.
$7?
$7 for one bloody video.
Was it the Buckingham Palace DVD or video shop?
Yeah, the video station, I think, at the time. Ooh. And, this is the 1989 film Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Now, a motion picture so grand, so magnificent, and so vast, it spans 7,000 years.
No way!
Yes way!
But it starts with Bill.
I'm Bill S. Preston!
Who is Joan of Arc?
And Ted.
Noah's wife?
We're in danger of flunking most heinously tomorrow.
A force from the future.
Can we go anywhere we want at any time?
You can do anything you want.
Is putting history at their fingertips.
Let's reach out and touch someone.
There's going to be a lot of that, isn't there? Marvellous. Now, this film, it does have a nostalgia factor for me as well. Probably around about 1990, my dad, being an electrician, managed to hook up Sky to our TV, not strictly legally.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, and these were in the days when Sky Television wasn't the big behemoth it is now.
Mm-hmm.
It was a slightly laughable cable TV station. It had one channel, which was called Sky TV, which showed... It shows things like 21 Jump Street, but its own talent shows things like Sky Star Search that was presented by Keith Chegwin. So real top-of-the-mill stuff.
Yeah.
But then it had a movie channel,
ooh,
which was called Sky Movies, which basically is as Sky Movies now. It shows the same three films over and over
and ad nauseam
again.
Yeah.
Its real peak was on Christmas Day. It had a Christmas triple bill of On the Buses movies. Amazing. But... then they started showing proper Hollywood new releases, and so one of the first ones they were proud to announce was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that it was on regularly, like every week or something. So if my mum was going out with the girls, which she used to do every Thursday night, me and my dad would open a couple of beers, get some fried chicken, and we'd either watch The Commitments or we'd watch Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Quite the contrast.
Yeah, and my dad bloody loves Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
That's nice.
He would constantly, he still quotes it now. If I talk to him, he does, honestly. Yeah, he loves it. So this is nice for me. I enjoyed going back on this one.
I can't imagine that. It'd be like hearing Windsor Davies talk like a dude or something. Like
there's one line in particular that makes him cry, which we'll talk about, because it occurs quite late in the film. Yeah. But I'll try and do it in his accent as well.
It is quite a quotable film, of course.
Oh, that's yes.
Probably it's saving grace in a way.
Yeah. This is one that it often gets referred to as like a stoner. It's one of the first stoner movies.
But there's nothing, there's no unsavoury or unwholesome activity in it at
all. It's incredible. The only unwholesome thing is that they lust after his stepmother.
Yeah.
That's probably about as far as it goes. But I suppose it's that kind of slacker vibe that they give off, which we'd seen in early Richard Linklater films and things like that, but was immediately followed by, you know, the Wayne's World and really Dude, Where's My Refund and all that sort of stuff.
And you know, it was probably a rating thing as well. I mean, it's very much pitched at, you know, put it this way, when I was a 9 or 10 year old watching it, I felt like it was speaking on my level.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And, yeah, so, you know, Bill and Ted themselves are very wholesome. They do order a beer when they get to the Old West, but, you know, they don't even think they get to finish it.
And he's smoking a cigar when they're playing poker. Oh, yeah, but that's about as unwholesome as it gets, I think.
Exactly. So, and that, you know, their whole attitude is just very positive and nice and
incredibly optimistic.
They're
lovely, the whole way through.
They're lovely guys.
One of the first things I noticed, and we might be getting ahead of ourselves, is normally when you get unintelligent characters in films, I find them really annoying and unlikable. I don't find stupidity funny.
Yeah,
for stupidity's sake.
Sort of like, dude, where's my car?
Absolutely. You know, or you see people on reality shows and they're thick, and you go, oh, lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
That doesn't do it for me at all. But these two guys are unbelievably likable.
Yeah.
You really root for them the whole way through.
And I think, you know, the success of this film, because it was a modest box office success, and you know, it's now become a sort of recognized as a bit of a cult classic. If you had two leads who just weren't likable, it would just go nowhere.
It wouldn't work at all.
And the thing is that they're thick, but they're kind of morally well developed.
Yes.
You know, they're not sort of morally bankrupt, kind of selfish or slacker losers. And of course it launched the career of Keanu Reeves.
Yeah. Yeah, his performance in this is he's so good in it.
He's so good.
He just bounces constantly.
Yeah. Like a puppy dog.
Yeah. Little ticks and shrugs that he does are just lovely.
And Alex Winter, of course, didn't quite go on to the same level of success.
But, yeah, I put it down to his curly hair.
Yeah, and he's kind of, for me, he will always be the creepy evil vampire in The Lost Boys as well. And that crop top that he wears throughout doesn't really help. Do we really need to see your midriff, Alex Winter?
Something a lady would wear in an 80s pop video, yeah.
But, you know, you can totally see the star quality of Keanu Reeves in this. It just sort of shines out. And because of this film, he was kind of unfairly tarnished in a way with this kind of slacker dude sort of vibe.
It's very true.
And then I think this, combined with the terribly wooden performance he gave in Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula, for a while it kind of pegged him as a bad actor.
Yeah.
But he's actually not a bad actor. No. You know, he's got a limited range, perhaps, but...
But you look at his early performances, everything like
River's Edge,
him and Crispin Glover are amazing in that.
Yeah. And then sort of My Own Private Idaho after this. Yeah. And,
You forget that he did actually have some range. I think he won various awards on the stage when he was a teenager. He was like the next big thing. But yeah, his performance is so good in this. That's what everyone thinks he's like in real life.
Yeah. And by all accounts, he's actually quite a lovely chap.
I've seen and heard a lot of interviews in his, and he's gorgeous. He's lovely. I don't fancy him.
Don't you?
No.
After seeing John Wick, I kind of did. But
to be fair, I do quite fancy 50-year-old Keanu Reeves.
So anyway, after that Keanu gushy love fest, directed by Stephen Herrick of Critters fame, had a bit of a kind of middling journeyman, mid-90s run there with 101 Dalmatians Alive. He did the crappy Brat Pack
Three Musketeers.
Which launched the career of Chris O'Donnell. Well, this kind of... Was that before or after Scent of a Woman? Might have been after Scent of a Woman.
Yeah, it was after Scent of a Woman, but that was a hell of a launch.
Yeah, did the Mighty Ducks, which sort of helped prop up, Emilio Estevez's mortgage payments for a while. And Mr. Holland's Opus, which was a real box office smash, and Richard Dreyfuss got an Oscar nomination.
He did. It was proper Oscar fodder, that film.
Yeah, and then he just kind of went on to absolute shitty oblivion, didn't he?
I looked on IMDb, but I kind of lost interest in what he was doing after that. It seemed to be a lot of direct-to-DVD and episodes of TV shows.
Strange sequels to things you never heard of.
The writers, Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon.
Son of Richard Matheson.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Who, of course, wrote one of your faves, Somewhere in Time.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. Richard Matheson's a cracking writer, yeah.
So he'd be slightly disappointed with how Son's career's panned out, but...
But Ed Solomon did. He's done quite well. I think he wrote Men in Black.
He wrote Men in Black. We won't mention Super Mario Brothers. Did Charlie's Angels, which was sort of a bit of a success, I guess. It's Gary Shandling's show from TV for a while.
One of my favourite theme tunes.
He's definitely got writing chops. And I think he was uncredited for some work on X-Men as well.
He wrote those. I mean, I don't like them, but they were very popular. Those magician films. Now You See Me.
Oh, yeah, no, he did those,
which I'm not a fan of, but they're very popular.
Yeah, I started watching the first one and I sort of got kind of bored with it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What it was about, it was really boring.
Yeah, yeah. And I heard the second one was just shit. So
I couldn't get over the fact that, was it Morgan Freeman's job was meant to be somebody who debunks magic tricks, as if everyone thinks they're real.
So they just plucked a normal person off the street, didn't it?
That's not a job. That's everybody in the world.
Is he playing Darren Brown? Slightly miscast, perhaps. Yeah, and a little interesting fact is in the sequel, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, the big bad guy played by Joss Ackland is called Denomalos, which is Ed Solomon backwards.
I went to see Bogus Journey at the cinema.
Yeah, so did I, actually. They actually have a baddie in that one, a proper baddie, so that kind of helped the plot a bit.
Yeah, baddie isn't history.
Or just a grumpy dad. I quite like the opening credits to this.
I didn't.
You didn't?
No, I didn't get it at all.
It seemed really sci-fi to me, this weird kind of polygony, golden, conical shape thing coming through the star-shaped orifice to Big Pig's Breakaway, which is about as 90s a sort of a butt rocker track as you can kind of hope for.
For me, it was what we're about to see, which is really madcap screwball.
Yeah.
It just didn't really fit with it. I didn't like the song, sorry. And the CG of the opening credits, I found really, really odd. I thought it was a very strange, underwhelming opening.
It kind of lulls you into thinking it's a straight sort of sci-fi, if low budget sci-fi.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Hmm, yeah, no, I can see that. Yeah, I enjoyed the 90s jam. And straight into kind of George Carlin against the black screen, the late George Carlin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, talking about this utopian future that we've got ahead of us 700 years in the future. So he's in San Dimas, California.
In the year
2688,
something like that.
Yeah, so almost exactly 700 years from when this was made. And it's a total utopia. Bowling averages are way up. Mini golf scores are way down. And we have more excellent water slides than any other planet.
Sounds great, doesn't it? Yeah, except for that, I'm not a fan of mini golf, but the water slides will do for me. Mm.
And then it's kind of, we get into, the first plot issue, really, where he just kind of says, 700 years ago, the two great ones, who of course are Bill and Ted, ran into a few problems. And he's kind of got to sort them out.
Yes.
The kind of the problem with the script is that it's going for like the Terminator, but there's no Terminator.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost as if Michael Biehn's character in the Terminator just went back just to make sure everything was going to just be fine. No one's coming back to stop John Connor being born. I just want to just make sure it happened.
Because depending on your understanding, because I don't really understand time travel philosophy, but I've got an excellent email to read out later from somebody. It would have happened anyway, because obviously he's there, so you don't need to go back and intervene. It's one of those paradoxes.
It's just like if me and you invented a time machine right now, and then we thought, ooh, shit, we better travel back in time to make sure we're born.
Apparently it's called the grandfather paradox. Which alludes to the sort of killing baby Hitler thing. It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because if you go back in time and kill baby Hitler, you would immediately go, you wouldn't have done it because he's dead. And you go, well, why would I have to go back and kill some random Austrian bloke?
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
But normally you would have some sort of threat to begin with.
Yeah.
Rather than just like, we've got to go back to make sure they do what's already been done.
Yeah. Because if he doesn't go back, it changes nothing.
Yeah.
Because they're already living in that utopian future.
Yeah. So it's very strange. I mean, that's why the Terminator is there, because he's a threat to, he's going to fuck everything up.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if that was just a deliberate, we don't care. This is a trash movie that's,
I think it gets away with it because it is so daft.
Yeah. And the pace of it just moves along at such a ripping pace. It's only 89 minutes long. You never really pause for thought too much.
No. Oh, absolutely not. There's some plodding moments, but very, very few. So we're immediately into the garage.
We're immediately into the garage.
Similar to the Back to the Future opening.
I was going
to
say, I almost expected Marty McFly to walk in with a tray of... Yeah. Hot chocolate or something. And we straight away meet Bill S. Preston Esquire and Ted Theodore Logan, who are the Wild Stallions. The spelling is just, it's charming, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
And they have a kind of real circular discussion about why they need to learn. They learn guitar. Well, actually, no, they need Eddie Van Halen playing guitar. No, this is why we need a good music video.
We need a really good video. But then we need to learn our instruments. But that's why we need Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah.
But they do kind of realise that they need to learn their instruments.
Yeah. Yeah.
If they're going to get anywhere.
Because they're pretty shit.
Mm.
Yeah, after that, they come to that kind of conclusion. It's excellent.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of their little signature ear guitar move.
Which everybody used to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And we're straight away kind of introduced to their particular way of talking as well.
Mm.
Because they did become linguistic icons, really, Bill and Ted.
They did.
It's sometimes falsely referred to as surfer speak or valley speak.
Mm.
But there's a few online resources, actually, about kind of how they talk. And apparently San Dimas, which is a real place, is quite far from the coastline. And it's 25 miles from San Fernando Valley.
Right.
So it's not really surfer speak or valley speak. And Orion Pictures even released a phrase book with the sequel, Bogus Journey. Yeah, that they actually have their own way of talking, which they invented, really, in this film. And it's kind of characterized by an attempt to sound sophisticated. So
that's true.
You know, they quite often will put in quite nice adjectives, you know, like resplendent, triumphant.
Most triumphant, yeah. Bodacious, all these. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Most distinguished gentleman, and outstanding, atypical.
Mm.
And if something's bad, you know, it's egregious, heinous. Odious. But they've always just got like a really positive, as we've sort of mentioned, a really positive attitude and treat everyone equally. And that's kind of one of the lasting legacies of the film, I think, is the way they talk, of course.
Very much like Back to the Future, the rehearsal scene ends with them going, "We're late for school." So they run off to their history class.
Who's taught by the awesome
Felix Leiter.
The late Bernie Casey, who died last year.
He did, yes, I saw that. That's pretty sad.
One of our favourite podcasts, of course, is Smirsh Pod.
Mm-hmm.
So we should probably mention for Smirsh Pod, that it's the non-canon Felix Leiter.
It is.
And he's always cool and he's always pretty classy. And
He's got a great face.
He really has got a great face.
That sucker lemon face is brilliant.
It's sort of feline kind of eyes and his deadpan delivery in this is quite, I like this. And I also like how he's not just, he actually likes them. He likes Bill and Ted. He's not just an asshole teacher.
Well, that's right. Under different hands or a different script, it would have been that bullying, angry teacher. But the fact that he's very, very patient with them, and he clearly wants them to succeed, because he warns them, if you don't do well in this, you're out.
And his deadpan delivery when, so it's history class, of course, which we find out that they've got a final report due the next day. And they're on track to fail history. They're gonna fail unless they pass with an A+.
Mm-hmm.
And we get an idea of how competent they are at their history when he says to Bill, "So Bill, what you're telling me essentially is that Napoleon was a short, dead dude."
Yeah.
And then he makes Ted stand up, tell him who Joan of Arc was. His answer: Noah's wife.
Yeah.
Pretty much summed up their knowledge by them thinking that Caesar is a salad dressing dude.
I do like the fact that when they're talking about history, they're obviously reading the names on the blackboard and they think there is a historian called Socratic Method.
Sounds like a jungle DJ from like early 2000s. But I really enjoyed Bernie Casey's little bit with that. And, you know, it's, the humour's pretty clunky and it's pretty corny, but
I think knowingly so.
Yeah, it's kind of charming. They're in danger of failing most heinously tomorrow.
It is such... It's screenplay 101, isn't it? If you don't pass, it's all over.
Yeah.
That's basically every film in the world,
but
not spelled out as explicitly as in this.
Oh, well, then, of course, we meet Missy.
I mean Mom,
which becomes a really tiresome sort of recurring joke throughout the movie.
Now, in Bogus Journey, which I haven't seen for a long time, she ends up marrying Ted's dad, doesn't she?
Yeah. So this is kind of like the ickiest part of the whole kind of film series, really, is Missy, who's only, I think, she was a senior when they were freshmen.
Yeah.
And who's now married to, in this movie, Bill's
dad. Sort of,
you know, late 40s dad.
He's a really icky scene.
He's
in the bedroom.
It's gross.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
That's really horrible.
Where Bill's dad ends up banging Missy in Bill's bedroom.
Yeah, he gives him some money, tells him to go out so he can have it off with her in his bedroom.
It's that look he gives where he's sort of...
Oh, it's horrible.
Slowly closing the door.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of really infantile humour about how Ted and Bill and Ted both sort of are attracted to Missy, I mean Mom.
Mm.
And then just to hit home kind of the jeopardy that the boys are in, they stop off at Ted's place where we meet his dad, who's played by I've written poor man's Richard Jenkins.
Yeah. When I first saw it, I thought it was Richard Jenkins. I think a few times since I've seen him, I thought, oh, he's the guy from Bill and Ted,
It's just, he could have been Richard Jenkins' stunt double.
Richard Jenkins, you know, you see people like Joey Travolta or Ken Swayze or whatever he's called him.
Yeah.
This is like his younger brother, like Alan Jenkins or something like that.
Because, I was the same. I always thought, oh, this is where Richard Jenkins turns up. But then it's like, hey, that's not Richard Jenkins. Yeah, he's a very authoritarian, sort of conservative police officer. And he's told Ted that he's going to send him to Oates Military Academy.
In Alaska.
If he doesn't pass his history final. Mm. And you can just see that Ted would really not fit in too well in that environment.
But his dad is also expecting him to fail because he's basically saying, it doesn't matter, pack your bags, you're leaving tomorrow. Yeah. So he doesn't believe in his own son, effectively.
No, and so he is the authoritarian prick that the history teacher isn't, thankfully. And of course, then we have Chekhov's missing keys.
Yeah, I've written that down. Chekhov's keys.
Because Ted's dad is missing his car keys. Mm. And he straight away assumes it's Ted that's taken them, but we'll get to that later.
Yes. At the same time in the future, Rufus is told it's time.
Mm.
So he gets in his time-travelling phone box. Never seen one of those before.
No. Is it an homage to the TARDIS, or...?
Apparently in the original script it was like a big van, like a transit van, but that was considered too close to Back to the Future, so they went with the other big time-travelling vehicle instead.
And it's just a shit TARDIS because it doesn't have the whole relative dimension.
It's pretty cramped in there, It's actual dimensions in space,
Yeah, and the future just kind of looks like a weird rich person's, kind of like a rich fashion designer from the 80s. It's something cocktail party or something. Yeah,
it doesn't look a particularly nice.
No,
future.
It looks very cold and sterile and emotionless.
Yeah, and the music's a bit rubbish.
Yeah,
I didn't like it. It's like it's played at the wrong speed.
And so there's these kind of three almost like overlords that sit there and conjure up some kind of
ball thing.
Ball-y thing, and they say, this is again the total illogic of the plot. It is time. Their separation is imminent. Well, no, it isn't, because obviously...
Because you're here, obviously, you don't have to do anything.
It all worked out, you know?
They're talking about partying on, and just enjoy yourself, and you don't have to go.
So I think, it's sort of the big annoying thing of the film for me. But anyway, let it go, Rob. And then we cut back to, again, just reinforcing how shit Bill and Ted are at history. They're sort of trying to cram for their final and... You know, who was Abe Lincoln? Had wooden teeth, chased Moby Dick.
Yeah.
So then, they're at a loss. They go to the Circle K, and then Rufus, in his time-traveling phone box, the heavens open, and he zaps down in some pretty sort of self-consciously crappy special effects. Yeah. I remember at the time thinking, oh, yeah, this is fine. This isn't...
But they still sort of are in the style of the film.
Yeah.
It's if it was a serious time-travelling sci-fi epic, then obviously it wouldn't work. But for what this is, which is effectively a comic book, then, fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like it how they say when the machine sort of lands, they both say, not bad!
Yeah.
Rufus steps out. I do like it how in the future they have those kind of little, kind of really plasticky-looking, sharky kind of sunglasses.
Yeah, like Geordie LaForge sunglasses, basically, yeah.
Yeah, and Rufus, almost like a kind of a parody of like a Terminator kind of line, gentlemen, I'm here to help you with your history report, you know.
Yeah, it is a come with me if you want to move kind of line, isn't it?
Yeah, and I do enjoy Ted's line, strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
So he sort of explains that, you're gonna go back, you're going to visit three people from history.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he doesn't really explain that either. He just says, here's a time machine, off you go.
Yeah, you were getting a bit Christmas Carol there. You're
going to. Yeah.
This is if Dickens wrote it. Why not just bring them back kind of like an A-plus worthy history report? Why not just bring them back?
You just know, write like, a really good report.
Cliff's notes, here you go. It's A-pluses, you're fine. This is the other thing. Even when I was nine, I remember going, well, how do they pass just from like having like actors pretend to be?
Yeah, that's one of my. Does it really deserve an A+?
Yeah. You know, it's like wow, A for effort.
Yeah,
but have you kind of explained anything A+ worthy about history just by?
Because let's go back to the start. Though. The report was what would people from history think of modern-day San Dimas.
Yeah.
It wasn't right about them.
Yeah.
So I suppose it ticks those boxes.
Yeah.
Because one of them says he loves San Dimas. So but yeah, you're absolutely right. They should have just gone slightly into the future and just overwritten the mark in the book. That would have done
it. Exactly. There's a whole... Yeah.
I can save so much time.
I can't decide if it's just like, it's just deliberately, let's just... the plot is just, you know, secondary to the kind of fun vibe.
Oh, completely.
And so, you know, I'm probably being a bit pedantic here.
But that's why we're here.
Yeah, yeah. And I also enjoyed the line, as soon as Rufus steps out of the time machine, "Do you know when the Mongols rule China?" So, then of course they're quickly joined by their future selves.
Future Bill and Ted, yeah.
Mm. They dabble with, because any good time travel movie, of course, has to have some of these mind-bending, like you were talking about the grandfather paradox, and these mind-bending kind of paradoxes and an internal logic to to the time travel. They kind of dabble with some of that stuff, but none of it's really that clever, is it? Really?
No, not at all. No, it's all there for the fun, as you said. I think slightly later it gets a little bit clever, and you have to sort of think about it a bit more, where we talk about things like the keys and the placeholders they've left in the future.
Yeah.
That bends your brain a little bit more. But yeah, this is just for silly fun.
Yeah. So future Bill and Ted come in, and the thing that I quite enjoyed is you only learn Rufus's name because future Bill and Ted say it.
That's right.
So they never actually learned Rufus's name.
Yeah, he never introduces himself. That's absolutely right.
And they kind of say, you know, "Hey, you're going to go on a most excellent adventure through time," and da da da. You do notice that there's a few
cramped some faces people,
in their one.
Well, you only look for that on the second viewing.
Yeah, yeah. And Rufus kind of takes them aside for a little private conversation, make sure everything's working out.
To which he then shouts, don't forget to wind your watch.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course they have to prove that they're future Bill and Ted as well by, you know, what number are we thinking of? 69!
Yeah.
And then they do the excellent...
So Rufus takes them on their first trip. He takes them to... Austria.
Yeah, yeah, and he tells them that they travel through the circuits of history. Mm. So that's our little time travel conceit.
I like that.
Yeah.
The wires and stuff. I really like that.
These giant big sort of cables that they sort of fly through. Yeah, they land in Austria, 1805.
In the middle of the Napoleonic Wars. I don't mind why they were there. They turn up and he goes, right, let's go then.
Yeah, was it almost just to kind of show them, look, this is what happens. You travel somewhere and then you can...
It just seemed, seeing as he keeps saying, you know, time runs parallel and we have to really hurry, we just turn up and go, right, oh, come on, off we go, then let's go.
Yeah, yeah, because that's a good point. Time does run parallel, so they can't just go and fuck around and in the circuits of history for several days. Yeah. They've still got to treat it as, 12 hours or whatever they've got.
Although they do in the sequel at the end.
Yeah.
Because they disappear for 5 years and come back to the same spot.
That's
if time runs parallel, that
looking
doesn't
like
work.
ZZ Top.
Yeah. Yeah, if time runs parallel, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
But they
also hang out with William Sadler's death throughout the whole movie.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough.
He's the highlight of that film.
Butch on Sundance, the early years.
Yeah, so land in Austria, Bill says, "That was most unprecedented, Rufus." And then in a really shitty kind of conceit, Napoleon's there, a sort of cannon...
Explodes,
and he somehow sort of blows up. Because you get the impression he's like miles away from them.
Yeah.
And then he sort of blows up and falls.
It's a big explosion.
Because
he's watching them through like a telescope or something,
And he falls into their sort of slipstream or whatever. And I have to say, Napoleon is my favourite of the historical figures.
He's very enjoyable.
He's just an arrogant, imperious little goblin twat, isn't he?
He's up there with Ian Holmes' Napoleon in Time Bandits, I think.
Yeah. And they probably mine the most comedy out of him.
Yeah, there's a lot of fun to be had with Napoleon.
Yeah. And then they travel back to present-day San Dimas.
And Napoleon falls out of a tree, so they realise that they've abducted Napoleon from the past.
Yeah.
So this is where they get the idea, let's go and get some more.
And Rufus goes away and he flies off, and then an empty one comes back down. They go back into Ted goes back into his house, and I quite enjoyed it because his dad is wearing an NRA windbreaker.
I didn't notice.
Just to hammer home what a total bastard he is. And we find out that he's already booked Ted's flight, he's leaving tomorrow night.
So he's told to stay put, but luckily his dad gets a call from Deputy Van Halen. He says, "I found your keys, if you want them, come and get them," which is Ted's chance to escape.
Ted escapes, they go back into the time machine, which of course has that handy phone book of where you can dial anywhere you want to go. They talk about going to find Sigmund Freud.
And Beethoven.
Yeah.
The pronunciation is one of the things that I've always loved about this.
Yeah.
I'm like, Socrates and things like that.
Yeah, always, Socrates.
Always
yeah.
made me laugh.
I do remember sort of having Socrates jokes for sort of.
Oh, you would have done, of course, Socrates yeah. Johnson. Yeah.
This is kind of where probably the film starts flagging a bit when they're doing the actual time travel.
I think there's a problem with pacing in that some are quite a nice length, like the Billy the Kid abduction is good, but the one in England just goes on for way too long.
And then others are just totally perfunctory.
Just montage.
Yeah, there's Joan of Arc, there's Sigmund Freud. Yeah, so they go to the Old West and go into a saloon and order a beer and Billy the Kid comes in and it's all very, almost kind of high school production.
It's like Carry On Cowboy. It's that vision of the Old West.
Yeah. And Billy the Kid, you know, takes to time travel. There's very little.
He's great with it. He's not freaked out for a second.
I found it kind of strange, though, like when. I can't remember why everyone's chasing after them. Oh, they cheat at poker.
Yeah.
So they've got this little mob after them. And they run back to the time machine, which is, of course, this little box. And Billy the Kid's standing there, sitting there with his gun going, "Where are we going, guys?" Like he knows it's some sort of vehicle.
What he should be saying is, "Let's run. I'm in a box. Run."
It's like, okay, you've already like explained to him that this is a... And then, straight away after that, they go to ancient Greece to get Socrates.
Socrates.
It's, look at it under Socrates. Where Ted sort of philosophizes with Socrates.
Now, that is a lyric to something, isn't it?
It's Kansas.
Okay.
Dust in the Wind.
Right.
Yeah. So, have you seen Old School?
I have.
Yeah. Well, when Blue, the old chap, dies, Will Ferrell's character sings Dust in the Wind.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's quite a good... It's very dated.
Yeah.
But sort of, 70s kind of ballady.
Yeah, I'm not really up on my sort of 80s American soft rock.
Yeah.
It didn't really do it for me.
So Ted says, picks up some sand from this thing. Mm-hmm. And all we are is dust in the wind, dude. And Socrates finds that
sort enlightening
and giggles and then runs off with them for...
Yeah, fine, you can kidnap me then.
Strangely dressed people.
For the wisest man on the planet. He's not very clever, is he?
No. And then, the next sort of leap, getting into quantum leap sort of terminology here, really does show kind of the level of analysis they're putting into kind of history, because they just go back to medieval times, which could be anywhere between the 5th and 15th century, and in the time of King Henry.
Yeah, which one? Yeah. I mean, I know Henry II was medieval. He murdered the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yeah.
So we know all that. But it's very, very odd. Let's just pick the most common name for a king and the most sort of flexible time period in history.
Yeah. So there's no Kenneth Branagh sort of Shakespeare quoting king coming up here. Of course, we forgot to mention princesses are brought up when future Bill and Ted come down and say hi to the princesses. And then we see these princesses on our balcony.
That must be the princesses that we told ourselves about. I always enjoy lines like that. That's good.
They put on some suits of armour, have a fun little Star Wars kind of, Darth Ted. I'm Luke Bill. And you're not my father.
This is where it started to drag for me.
Yeah.
It goes on quite a long time with no sort of resolution at the end of it.
No. I wonder, because I didn't actually check this, that is a relatively impressive-looking castle. So I'm not sure where the location was.
I don't know.
I just wonder if this was the most costly kind of set that they'd done. And so they thought, fuck.
We may as well use it.
Yeah, let's spend 10 minutes here.
And
it is sort of pointless.
Because they don't take anyone back with them.
They don't take anyone back with them. They have an awkward chat with the princesses who they've sort of immediately fallen in love with.
Mm. And they plan on stealing a peasant, but that doesn't work out.
Grumpy medieval ugly dude wants to throw them in Iron Maiden. Which they are like, Iron Maiden.
Yeah, which is funny. Yeah, that's great.
they have a little fight with a guard.
Oh, because he thinks he's killed Ted, so he has a bit of a fight with him.
You killed Ted, you medieval dickweed.
That's it. Yeah. And they call him a bonehead as he smacks him on the head with a giant bone.
Yeah. And then there's a sort of a kind of a rescue. They're about to get beheaded and Billy the Kid and Socrates come and rescue them.
Mm. Which I think is all then again used in the Three Musketeers film that Herrick directed. Yeah, I think it's exactly the same rescue.
Yeah. Oh, and also similar to Never Say Never Again when Sean Connery rescues...
Yes! Was he Felix Leiter? Yeah. Probably went, I've got an idea. Yeah. I've got an idea for a scene.
Yeah, Bernie Casey's notes there. Then they jump to the future, don't they?
They only go to the future because when they're being chased, one of the knights like hurls a mace at the phone box and it smashes the aerial or the antenna.
Yeah.
So they end up going to the future. Coincidentally, exactly the same place in time that... Yep. That Rufus was sent from.
Yeah.
Which must be infinite possibility of that.
So, and Rufus isn't there for some reason. And it's the three weird fashion designer people.
Yeah.
Sitting in their chairs and then...
Well, they enhance the fact that they look like fashion designers. When they try and do air guitar, it just looks like they're doing cross stitch. Yeah. They do it really badly.
It's those sort of pompous kind of air guitar.
Yeah.
And then slowly sort of like Ewoks coming out from the... From the forest, the
forest creatures in Snow White, just looking like, it's okay.
Or the Vendigum.
Yeah.
Just to harken back to previous podcast. Some of the future denizens sort of come out and sort of revere Bill and Ted. And,
They do these, they quote as almost like religion.
Yeah.
Bill and Ted's like, be excellent to each other and party on, dude.
Yeah.
It's like Idiocracy, really, isn't it?
It is a bit, yeah. Because, of course, we never... Well, actually, we do learn in the final scene, which is a very odd place to put a whole ream of exposition, why Bill and Ted are so fundamental
to this. Yeah.
I also kind of thought it was a little bit strange just to set it 700 years in the future, for them to still be so iconic 700 years
ago. Yeah, I mean, how bad must future music be?
Yeah. So then they jump out again from that time zone. We cut to Napoleon.
Ziggy Piggy.
Yeah, Ziggy Piggy. Because Ted has bribed his little brother Deacon to look after Napoleon while they're jumping around time.
Mm.
And Deacon has taken him to the mall.
It's almost like a double date with a child.
Yeah. Yeah, there's two sort of prepubescent sort of girls.
I mean, Deacon's obviously got his chum or girlfriend, and so he set up Napoleon with one of her mates.
Like a 12-year-old. Yeah.
Well, was Napoleon known for... I know he was short, but was he known for that?
No, it was just maybe to look inconspicuous. Like, maybe they should have taken his hat off.
But... Yeah. Yeah, he's very dressed as Napoleon, yeah.
And gigantic bowl of
it's
ice
really
cream.
Good.
Looks really, really cool. Called the Ziggy Pig.
Delivered by the two writers.
Ah, I didn't realise.
Yeah, that's Matheson and Solomon.
Oh, wow.
In a little cameo there, yeah.
And it's quite a good, it's a memorable cameo.
Yeah.
Because they're totally obnoxious, obviously, this thing they do for kids after Napoleon's polished off this.
But it's awful. It's talk about fat shaming. You eat a big bowl of ice cream and they come up and basically call you a fat pig.
Well, it is a large bowl of ice cream.
Yeah, it looked bloody good, though.
They come and put a little fake pig nose on you.
Yeah.
On you. And then they sing, behold, he's devoured the Ziggy Pig. That means you're a Ziggy Piggy, Ziggy Piggy.
And then they flip their noses up like in the League of Gentlemen.
Yeah.
Like Edward and Tubbs, and just go and run away.
The way that Napoleon's just covered in ice cream all over his face, and the way that he sort of fights the girl he's with to get that last
bit of leglass.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then we're basically into kind of like time travel montage.
It's montage territory, yeah, yeah.
Beethoven's playing Führer Liszt, they pick him up.
Mm-hmm. They go to Vienna and they take Froude.
Yeah, Froude.
Go to Orléans. Get Noah's wife. A very old 17-year-old
yeah.
Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
Played by one of the Go-Go's, Jane Wheedlin.
Is she?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
She sang Rush Hour, which was her big solo hit. But she was in the Go-Go's.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Because she's quite charming.
Yeah, she is.
She hasn't got a lot to work with, but... She
works it.
Yeah. They go back to Mongolia, find Genghis Khan, mm-hmm. They tempt him with a Twinkie.
Yep. Now, I saw some, I don't know if it was on IMDb or somewhere else,
mm.
It's claimed that when he's taken, he shouts, motherfucker.
Oh.
I listened, sort of sounds like it. It's like, motherfucker, as he's taken into the phone box.
It's sort of like one of those urban legends. That...
Yeah.
Oh, I have to watch it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't notice that. Then they go back, of course, get Captain Ahab.
Who didn't have wooden teeth?
Surely, this is a lot of effort just for a history report.
You could have had a lot of fun with some of those characters in the abduction scenes.
Yeah.
Maybe not Sigmund Freud. But some of the others, Joan of Arc is really underserved in this.
Yeah. They could have got her just when she's about to get burnt at the stake or... Yeah.
Which is interesting, because I also read another bit of trivia, which you've probably read as well, but pretend you haven't for the sake of the podcast, is that one of the original ideas, or the first draft of the script, had them going to historical events where they accidentally caused a disaster. Them. So they were on the Titanic and the Hindenburg and things like that, which for a comedy is very dark.
Yeah.
But for time travel logic, it makes sense.
That's quite... funny.
Yeah, I think so too.
I can see how if it was every single scene was like that, it kind of got a bit cute, sort of, you know, now we're causing another...
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's good.
It's possible because they did something similar in Time Bandits, because they were on the Titanic.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I quite like that idea. I think that's quite fun.
That is a fun idea.
Yeah.
Because, in this one, you know, they just, obviously everyone, spoiler alert, gets just returned.
Mm.
And surely they would be changed by their... time travel experience.
Well, imagine Lincoln's next address.
Yeah.
But I think most of them were murdered violently. Not long afterwards. Billy the Kid was, Joan of Arc was, Lincoln was. So maybe they did open their mouths and they were just killed for being insane.
Oh, that could be the next sequel.
Yeah.
Which I think is in the works.
Face the Music, I think it's called. Yeah, I think Keanu Reeves announced last year that they're working on it. I think it's called Bill and Ted Face the Music.
And that could be a really...
it's just going to be our children are travelling through time.
Yeah, and who wants to see sort of 53-year-old men talking like this as well? I mean, Alex Winter could probably do with the paycheck.
He's an established director. He makes a lot of documentaries.
Oh, yeah, but I don't know if he's raking in the cash.
He's probably not on the same paycheck as Keanu.
I did watch Freaked, which was the kind of horror comedy film that he directed in the 90s with Randy Quaid, wasn't it? It's not good.
No, it's probably not strong.
Yeah, and then of course the damaged area was now causing a bit of trouble for them. So they end up in prehistoric times, don't they?
They do, like a 1 million BC or something like that.
And they fix the area with everyone does this kind of chain of chewing gum.
They do the chewy,
and smush it all together and with some tins of.
I'm not sure what he was giving out. It was like a pudding.
Yeah.
But at the end, I did notice as the caveman are watching, one of them is actually chewing gum.
Yeah,
a little spot.
They went to the Tim Burton ape walking school as well. Those cavemen, didn't they? They're very chimp like.
Same makeup provider as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, back in modern day San Dimas, Napoleon's gone bowling.
Yeah. And he already knows to cheat at Tenpin bowling.
It's great, isn't it?
He's a smart man.
It's really funny.
He's caught on very quickly. His technique lacks something to be desired, but has a big hissy fit when he launches the. I got a ball.
Good use of subtitles. Really good. Each shit just appears after each other. It's great.
Yeah.
But they ditch him. They just abandon him and he gets kicked out for not paying in the bowling alley and he's left to his own devices.
Deacon ditches him because he was a dick.
He was a dick.
You can't argue with that. So they return back to present-day San Dimas.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. They don't come back to modern-day San Dimas.
They
come back to yesterday's San Dimas.
Oh, sorry, yesterday's
where
San
they
Dimas.
Meet their historical selves.
Yes, of course, and they're now the future. Mm. Yeah.
Because, he says, well, why did we... We then learn that when Rufus has taken them aside for that chat that I was alluded to earlier, they say, well, how come we're still at yesterday? How come we're not today? And he says, you have to dial one number forward. That makes no fucking sense.
I didn't get that.
None at all.
I wasn't sure if it was supposed to be kind of just a funny joke that maybe makes more sense in the States. I don't know.
No, it was an excuse to have them meet each other, basically.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
That I do remember going, that? But you have to dial one number forward, stupid, or something.
Yeah, because if he's saying that time keeps running, that number should be correct in the phone book.
Yeah.
But that's when he learns that he hasn't wound his watch.
Yeah.
So he reminds his historical self, don't forget to wind your watch.
Because they think they've got,
I think they've got 10 hours.
10 hours and then they've got 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's when they dial one number more and they do appear in Bill's garden.
And Missy's.
It's now. Yeah. Missy's gardening. And then they introduce everybody, which is Dave Beethoven, Maxine of Arc, Herman the Kid, Bob Genghis Khan, Socrates Johnson, Dennis Froude, and Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
Just give up at the end.
And it's just like, that is just kind of charming humour.
It's wonderful. Well, one of the things that used to make me laugh, me and my brother used to make the same joke as a kid.
Yeah.
They do it in this, and I still do it today,
yeah.
is you assume it's their surname. So his surname is Of Arc, or his surname is The Kid. I've always loved that, and I still use it. When I take my kids shopping and they're naughty, I say, well, Mr. Pack and Mr. Save are going to find out about it.
Yeah, that's very good. They land on Missy's hose, garden hose, don't they slop in it, as she notices, and yeah.
And then we have a pointless tidying the house at high speed montage.
That was pointless, because she won't let them go off and do their things without finishing their chores. For an 89-minute movie, you know, do you really need this scene?
But it also had that kind of Benny Hill speeded up kind of thing, which I didn't even find funny when I saw this first time, to be honest.
Then they will go to the mall and have...
The best place for them to learn about modern-day San Dimas is take them to the mall.
Yeah.
Fair enough, that makes sense.
Bill and Ted decide to go and locate the missing Napoleon.
Mm.
They tell everyone just to stay there, sipping their slushies.
Yeah.
Now,
is there a deleted scene here? Because we learn that the water park he walks into is called Waterloo. There must be a deleted scene where he's seen that and gone, Waterloo.
Yeah, there must. Yeah, but I don't know.
Because it's a good joke.
Yeah.
And it's not used.
They are assuming an incredible lack of sophistication in the audience throughout this film, though.
True.
You know, they are really... They're almost expecting the audience to be Bill and Ted. So maybe they kind of thought, oh no, that's too sophisticated. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's too clever.
But when they go to the mall, I do like it.
Yeah. It's almost like the gremlins running amok or something, isn't
it? Yeah, because each of them gets into hilarious scrapes.
Yeah.
We see Billy the Kid and Socrates chatting with girls with Singapore, which is really creepy.
Yeah.
Because Socrates is about 80.
Yeah.
And these are teenage girls. But it's really funny.
Yeah, and they would be teenage boys if it was Socrates.
Is that right?
Well, that was what he was forced to drink his hemlock for, I think. Corrupting the youth. And...
So who was the philosopher who had a turtle dropped on his head?
Oh, Aristotle. I don't know.
Oh my god. No, because one of those philosophers, my god, I have lost it.
You're turning into Ted.
One of a famous philosopher of that age, I can't remember which one, was actually outside, and legend has it, an eagle was carrying a turtle and dropped it on his head and he died.
Oh, God, no, I don't...
But I'm not sure who that was.
No, so Socrates drank hemlock, because I think he was accused of doing sort of mucky things with young boys, but I think it was more like a political kind of a thing as opposed to...
Basically what happens these days.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been all over the ancient Greek Twitter.
Yeah.
Like a photoshopped version of it or something.
Yeah. It was the ancient Greek yew tree.
I was thinking more like Corbyn's hat. Before it turns up with a big sausage. Which is actually quite a sophisticated joke.
Yeah.
When you're talking about Freudian issues.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually very funny.
And they try and mine a little bit of Freudian humor, but they just don't give it the space that it needs, do they? And I do quite enjoy the kind of random historical pairings.
Yeah.
That you get, you know, Abe Lincoln and Freud are kind of off on their little thing. And like you say, Billy the Kid and Socrates.
Yeah. It's almost a bit Avengers-y where, you know, Tony Stark and Bruce Banner would be good friends because they're both genius scientists. And
that
makes perfect sense.
And we totally missed the opportunity, you know, on Twitter, how there's been this kind of meme going around of, you know, Infinity War, the greatest crossover ever. We could have done this.
We could have.
Ah, damn it. That was so, like, 10 days ago as well. Damn it. Yeah, Joan of Arc goes to lead an aerobics class. Not sure the significance.
She's a woman. Let's just get her doing a lady thing.
Yeah. And Genghis Khan puts on some gridiron sort of pads and gets a baseball.
He smashes off a shop.
Jumps on a skateboard. Does a little flip off a trampoline.
He smashes the head off a mannequin. That kind of thing, which is fun.
Which is fun.
But Beethoven understandably goes to a music shop and he...
goes electric.
He likes shit synth music, basically. Abe Lincoln shoplifts.
So has a Winona Ryder moment.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking all that was really fun when I was a kid.
And it still is. Let's be fair. It is still good fun.
Yeah. And then we have the very funny Waterloo sequence where Napoleon and his Yeah, it's quite handy that he brought his swimming trunks.
Yeah, it's good he got his togs and his hat.
Yeah.
Because they weren't supplied by the park. It's got his logo. Not logo. It's got his emblem on there.
That is the Avengers, isn't it? Yeah. and he's very sort of hesitant about going down this water slide, and eventually gets sort of pushed in because he's holding up the line, and then just absolutely loves it.
Which is perfect, because that's what every kid feels when they go on one of those. They hate it first time, and you can't stop them.
Yeah. And there's a funny little kind of montage of him conversing with, like, six-year-olds about the water slide.
Well, initially he throws them out of the way so he can push them, but then it's like, come on, go on this one. He's carrying them through the queue.
Right. And just, even like when he's going down kind of on his chin on his elbow and stuff.
Yeah. I suppose you could argue that Napoleon is probably the only character in this that does have a character arc.
He does, yeah.
Because he's this awful, selfish man, but then he kind of involves everyone else and has fun. Nobody else changes at all throughout the whole film.
Exactly. And he actually gets to really experience the future.
Yeah.
And kind of, enjoy it or its delights. So, Bill and Ted go and find him and drag him away under protest.
While everybody else is on the run from the police through the mall. Something else I didn't notice, I keep talking about deleted scenes. Freud has got like a kick me sign on his back.
Oh.
When him and Lincoln are running away from the police.
Who put that on?
Because Freud doesn't get in any trouble.
No.
But he still gets arrested. There's a scene missing.
Yeah.
Where someone's put that on his back and kicked him or something.
They really wanted to get this under 90 minutes, didn't they?
Yeah, because Socrates calls him a geek. Yeah. And so obviously someone's put a sign on his back and hilarity has happened.
Yeah.
But they decided not to include that in the final 89-minute edit.
Oh, shit, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it's when they're going up the escalator and they're being chased.
Yeah,
he's got a kick me sign on his back.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, now and then we kind of get to this a little clevery time-travelly bit, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Where Bill and Ted go to the police station. They have to figure out how to get all their historical figures back.
So they plant things. They go in the past and they plant things there, which will help them in the future.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
I did find it amusing that there's no serious crime going on in San Dimas at that point, where every detective, not just cops, but detectives are checking in. Do you check in? Have you got any luggage, sir? Yeah. Do you check in when you're getting arrested?
Carry your bags to the cell for you. Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. Yeah, they really labour the jokes of Ted's dad as booking Abe Lincoln. Mm. And, I know how to spell Lincoln. And where's your date of birth? 1809.
But this is where we find out that Ted did actually steal his dad's keys, because it's a plan that he made in the future. He's hidden them. And apparently, from a sort of an infinite monkey cage perspective, that sort of makes sense, theoretically. That in a sort of time travel study or whatever, that kind of makes sense.
Couldn't they have just avoided doing anything then, if that works? Like, couldn't they have just sort of stood there when Rufus kind of first landed and gone, okay, we're going to do this, and this?
I suppose. But they've already done it. That's the thing.
It's
already been written. It's already happened.
So. Mm, yeah. So yeah.
And that is. Have you seen Arrival?
With
Amy Adams.
No, I heard it was kind of boring.
It is boring. Yeah. But the leaving the car keys in the past is basically that's the coda for the whole film. Yeah. And everyone goes, oh, wow, it's amazing. Yeah. It's just done in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. She learns from these aliens the theory of time travel, that time is not linear; it can be bent and amended.
Okay.
So to save the world. She basically goes back in the past and has a word with the Chinese ambassador saying, you need to save the world. And then that basically saves us. It's exactly the same as this. But that gets nominated for Best Picture.
Well, The Flash did the same thing in Batman vs. Superman to Bruce Wayne, and that got critically panned.
Exactly.
It's just when Denis Villeneuve directs something and everyone thinks it's arty.
Everyone creams their pants over Denis Villeneuve, yeah. But it's the same thing.
Mm.
And I like it. It makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So
we're now viewing some of the high school history reports.
Yeah, and this is quite funny.
We get everybody's favourite.
Yeah.
Which is the jock who's basically going, his computers, and realises he's failing.
Everything's moderner.
Yeah.
It's smaller, but larger.
Yeah, it's fabulous. So, of course, to save it, he just shouts, San Dimas High School Football Rules! And everyone goes crazy. It's really funny.
That's good, yeah. It's a good moment. Very good. Yeah, and then Bernie Casey, Mr. Ryan, sort of notes that we're missing one report, but
But again, he's written them off because it's not time for them to be there yet, and he's already given them an F. It's a bit harsh.
I suppose he's just, you know, a bit worried that they're not actually in the, even in the auditorium.
Good point, yeah.
And then we have the presentation of the final.
Yeah. They turn up, and it's sort of a below-par rock concert, if you like.
Sort of art installation. Conceptual art piece.
Yeah, so when you see a Tate Modern, they introduce, Billy the Kid comes on and fires a gun, but Socrates turns up and it makes me laugh. And they did say, like Ozzy Osbourne, he was repeatedly accused of corrupting the young. Which now you've said that I know what they're talking about.
Yeah,
and Beethoven gets introduced, and this is my dad's favourite line, where they say, you know, his favourite works include Mozart's Requiem, Handel's Messiah, and Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet. Even to this day, if there's any kind of heavy metal, my dad will just go, Bon Jovi, Slippery When Wet. Because he was in tears when he first saw that. He loves it.
That is a good line. Yeah. You know.
And so there's various scenes of Genghis Khan doing stuff, of Joan of Arc performing.
Yeah.
We see Napoleon talking about the invasion of Russia and it's not going to work.
None of which I would have thought is worthy of an A+ for a history.
Well, if it's supposed to be what do you like about San Dimas, the only one who says anything like that is Socrates, because he likes baseball. And billiards. And he loves San Dimas. That's the only one that says, it's all right here, isn't it?
And then they have Freud psychoanalyzing Ted. And because meanwhile, Bill and Ted's father have both kind of crept into the auditorium, like blaming each other's sons for the mess that they're in. And Freud psychoanalyzes Ted and says, actually, it's just, you know, your father's fear of failure that he's transferring onto you and there's nothing other than having gone to the effort, if you were sort of in the audience or the teacher going, wow, they've gone to the effort of getting all these actors to do all these kind of demonstrations, you still wouldn't necessarily think they've learnt anything much.
Because they basically did it and gone, hello, I'm Billy the Kid, I'm a cowboy from the past. That's it.
That's not even a Wikipedia entry.
You could at least say, I went to the mall. It was bloody great, actually.
But it's such a dazzling display.
Which ends with Lincoln's take on the Gettysburg Address, the 4 score and 7 minutes to go. Are we around about that point in the film? Because 4 score and 7 is 87 minutes. Are we in about the 87th minute? Might be. That's just coincidence.
Oh, very, very clever meta moment if it is.
So everybody loves it. Abraham Lincoln says, be excellent to each other and party on, dudes. And the place loves it. Yeah. A+ immediately. Just A+ for effort, basically.
Which, you know, you have to say, they did go to a lot of effort.
Yeah, they worked really hard. So then we're back in the garage. And it's clear that they've sort of learned nothing. It's the ultimate non-arc for characters. It's like a sitcom.
It's not even Joan of Arc.
No, thank you. They've gone back to the same place they started. They've learned absolutely nothing.
And Bill even says as much, doesn't he? He's just sort of like, you know, we've saved the world, we've done this, we passed the history final, but, you know, everything's still the same. And then Rufus turns up.
With their prizes, their rewards. He's given them some women.
They really need, you know, to ask some serious questions about consent here, I think.
He's abducted them.
He's abducted some princesses.
Yeah.
As, here you go.
Yeah. He's dressed them up like dogs' dinners.
Yeah.
Giving them some credit cards and going, here you go, lads. Here's your prize.
I would have thought that kind of raised some eyebrows, kind of all of a sudden, Bill and Ted have these young English lasses that are just sort of living with them. And
But also, if that was King Henry's castle, and they were the princesses, they've changed the royal lineage.
There probably would have been a war caused by that.
Well, it's like the princes in the tower. Yeah. If it had been princes, that makes sense as far as Richard III goes.
That would have been quite interesting.
But, of course, Bill and Ted aren't going to marry two small boys. They're going to give them to Socrates.
That would have been a very different movie. And then, which just structurally just fell really flat for me, Rufus just goes into this big exposition dump about why they're so important.
Yeah, exposition at the end.
Literally the final scene. Your music is going to go on to unify the world and
align the planets. Align and all the planets. Bollocks, yep.
We're going to communicate with extraterrestrial races with it. Mm. And
we've heard their music in the future. It's not very good.
Well, in the sequel, when they come back, they're just playing.
Kisses, God Give Rock and Roll.
To you, yeah.
I'm concerned by a universe that's going to be saved by such diluted, dire music. If it was like Jim Bob and Fruit Bat from Carter's Excellent Adventure, I'd understand, because their music's fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, I wonder if the third movie, if they do make it, is going to comment on any of that.
Mm.
If they're going to update it slightly, or
you'd have to. Yeah. It's called Face the Music.
Yeah, yeah. So.
So you'd have to. The other thing that bothers me here
is
that he says, oh, the princess is a part of the band as well. They're in the band. Well, why aren't they on the front of the CD? Why does everybody worship Bill and Ted and not the women? It's good to see in the future that women's equality as far as employment goes is just the same as it is now.
Yeah.
In other words, they're ignored totally.
Same old story. You know, oftentimes the backing singers do all the heavy lifting in a track and, you know, they just don't even get a mention.
Bjorn and Benny get all the awards.
Yeah.
With Agnetha and Annifred, we like them.
Yeah.
But they're just kind of second place, aren't they?
Wow.
And it's going to be the same in 700 years' time.
Yep.
That's quite bleak.
Agnetha was always the one that stuck with me.
Mm. Oh, that was the most laddish laugh ever. Oh, my.
She was always the one that stuck to me.
Oh, oh my word. So, we watched Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Is it still any good?
I always feel like I'm cheating when I try and qualify my answer here. Mm. But if I was a 10-year-old boy, yes. There's a charm to it. There's an undeniable charm to it, you know. But you know, it's not a good, you have to say it's not a good movie in the way that the plot, the writing, the structure... It is sort of formally a bad movie.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, there's an X factor to it from the dialogue, the chemistry between the leads, the sort of the fun, zany kind of energy behind it that works. So, yeah, I'm hedging a bit. But...
Yeah, I agree. It's story-wise, it's all over the shop.
Yeah.
The pacing's a little bit patchy,
yeah,
but there's so much of it to like,
yeah,
whether it be the performances, the screwball factor, the innocence of it.
Yeah,
if this was remade now, it would be cynical, it'd be a sort of a dirty edge to it, but that kind of freshness to it,
I
really, really enjoyed it again. I laughed out loud so many times watching it, and that got me through.
So it's the charming puppy dog that kind of like Ted is, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, and you can see why it spawned. It spawned a Saturday morning cartoon.
Mm.
You can see why it's become a cult classic.
Absolutely.
And you can see why Keanu Reeves got an incredibly successful career off the back of it.
Most definitely.
Wasn't a total waste of 90 minutes, 89 minutes then.
No, I don't think so. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Good.
I really, really did.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll rush along and watch Bogus Journey, which I did enjoy when I saw it. I think there's a lot more going on in that one.
They do try and make it a bit darker in Bogus Journey.
Yeah.
They do actually have a baddie and some actual menace. And...
Yeah, well, they get killed.
Yeah, and you know, replaced by those sort of robot Bill and Ted. And, but they kind of throw the whole kitchen sink in that one.
They certainly do.
And I think it made slightly less money, but cost sort of twice as much.
Mm.
So still made money. But
I think it was critically better accepted as well, because the first one was, reading through it, I was quite surprised it was critically panned. People hated it.
I think overall it's got like a 75% Rotten Tomatoes rating.
Mm.
But it's sort of that the prestige kind of critic panned it, saying that it wasn't, you know, it's not satirizing slacker idiots, it's kind of praising them.
And it's not doing enough with the historical figures.
Yeah, and you have to...
Oh yeah, they're just window dressing, basically. Other than the sausage joke with Sigmund Freud, there's not much they do with historical figures.
But, yeah, you know, it's got a following for a reason.
Mm. Oh, absolutely.
Verdict is not bogus... But excellent.
But excellent. Diddly diddly do.
So.
We've had some letters.
Ooh.
Well, some correspondence. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
When we announced we were doing this, we put it out on our social media. We asked people what their favourite time travel films were.
Okay.
Cool. I think you responded with...
12 Monkeys.
12 Monkeys. That was a popular choice with some of our other contributors. And I said Somewhere in Time. The very lovely Christopher Reeve love story with Jane Seymour.
Written by the writer of Bill and Ted's Dead.
That's right. So, other people who'd contributed, Jules Lawrence, who's written in before. Hello, Jules, from Brighton. Also like 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
And also the Spanish one, Time Crimes. Have you seen that?
No, but
it's very good.
I noticed a couple of comments saying that that's really good. Good. And I love the name, Time Crimes.
Time Crimes is great. It fulfills that whole kind of temporal loop thing where it's set in a 3-day period. You see a strange figure, turns out to be him from the future. It's that kind of feel to it. It's cool. Really great.
Yeah.
Apparently it's going to be remade in English. I hope not, because the Spanish one is fabulous.
Okay.
It's really, really cool. Andy Craig from Manchester also liked Time Crimes, and he suggested Time After Time, which is the H.G. Wells travels back in time to get Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, yeah.
It's great.
I love that when I was a kid.
It's really good.
Yeah,
I like it. It's David Warner, I think, isn't that, isn't he?
He's the Ripper, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
The one with Malcolm McDowell.
Malcolm McDowell plays H.G. Wells. And David Warner plays Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, and is Mary Steen?
She is, yeah. She's a bit of a time travel queen, yeah, absolutely. Matt Clark, who's also from Brighton, likes Looper.
I'm
not a fan of it.
I rewatched it only a couple of weeks ago. It was on Netflix or something, and I just, I had another stab at it, and I just didn't like it. And the internal logic of it, the internal time travel logic of it, didn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't.
So it's one of those things where something suddenly happens to you in the past, all of a sudden
your legs fall off.
Yeah. Which to me just
doesn't make sense.
It's nonsense. And yeah, and I still just haven't forgiven Rian Johnson for The Last Jedi either. and he still doesn't even look like Bruce Willis.
No.
He looks like...
He looks like Joseph Gordon-Levitt in... He looks like Max Headroom or something like that.
Yeah, have you ever seen the Living Colour video Glamour Boys?
Yeah.
And it's like Ken dolls. He just looks like a plastic...
It's like Kraftwerk or something.
Mannequin, yeah.
Or Crichton.
Yeah, it looks like Crichton. It's that same plasticky... Yeah. Just for a bunching.
We also had Shannon Dowsing, one of your friends from Gisborne.
Yes, I grew up with Shannon in Gisborne.
Likes the butterfly effect, which I would love to discuss in a separate podcast because it's one of those films that it's rubbish, but it's such good fun.
It's glorious rubbish, isn't
it? It's wonderful.
It's one of those just bonkers, doesn't make any sense really.
I love it. It tries to, though. It tries so hard to make sense.
And I love movies. It's almost like it. I love movies that have that kind of childhood icky shit going on in the childhood that kind of...
But also, depending on which version you've seen, because there's about 10 alternate endings, one of them in particular is so, so dark, it's laughable. It's where he projects himself back to his own fetus.
And he throttles
himself on the umbilical cord.
Isn't that the actual ending?
There's about four.
Oh, okay.
I've seen versions on the TV where he's alive and he basically changes something in the past again, but he's still alive and he walks past Amy Smart and they kind of notice each other, but she's obviously forgotten him, so he's managed to change it. There's about four different endings.
Okay.
But that's the bleakest.
Yeah, because for some reason I thought the self-strangulation with the umbilical cord was the...
There's a few. I think the DVD has got all of them on there. So if you ever get that out, it's like about an extra hour of different endings.
Great. Yeah. No, so yeah, that would be a good one.
And also Rob Marlin from Switzerland. He's trying to argue that Groundhog Day and Muppet Christmas Carol are time travel movies.
Typical... bloody Swiss answer. He's sort of on the fence about things, isn't he?
He's actually from the Wirral, but he lives in Switzerland. I know this.
Groundhog Day. I wouldn't. I've got problems with Groundhog Day as a time travel movie.
I've got problems with Groundhog Day as a film.
Yeah.
A man tricks a woman to sleep with him.
Well, yeah.
Doesn't really play out that well these days.
No. And it's one of those things. Bill Murray's whole back catalogue, I've revisited so many movies and I've thought, this is where his genius will, everyone loves Bill Murray, this is so good. And I've watched a few things and gone, fuck, that was, like Scrooge, I watched Scrooge recently, and God, it was just...
But even if you watch, like, Ghostbusters now, he's just a sexual predator.
He's just a dick, isn't he?
He's a stalker. Yeah. He's Andrew Lincoln in Love Actually. He's just a bad stalker.
So he holds... I can't remember the scene where he holds up a card going, enough now.
Yeah. he brings banoffee pie around to go on your movie, yeah. But we also had a couple of very interesting emails, which I won't read all out of, from Colin Wright, who lives in Wellington.
Yeah.
You probably know.
I don't, actually.
I think you met him once, because he used to work with me. Scottish guy.
Now,
he claims to know about things like this.
Okay.
Like I said, I think he listens to The Infinite Monkey Cage, and he really kind of studies that kind of thing. And so I sort of asked him about time travel in movies and what his favourite ones are and which ones kind of serve it better.
Makes sense.
And he acknowledged the fact that the Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and Bogus Journey are very, very silly.
Yeah.
But the whole placing things in the past makes sense from a time travel philosophy perspective. He says the one that does it, serves, gives it the best service until the end, is Flight of the Navigator.
Oh, yeah.
Because it actually does, which also Interstellar does, something that he calls, which is the twins paradox.
Okay, is this like when McConaughey is the one moving the books and...
It's more the if you travel somewhere at the speed of light, mm-hmm. which David does in Flight of the Navigator,
yeah.
you age less than somebody who's left on Earth.
Oh yes, yeah, yeah.
So
okay.
it's that twins paradox,
yep.
which is involved with sort of specific gravity. If you travel faster, the gravity increases, so time slows down, mm. which is what they use through Interstellar as well.
Yeah,
okay. So he said that's until he goes back in time at the end, which is ridiculous. In yep. Flight of the Navigator, that actually serves it a lot better.
I really I enjoyed that movie as a kid as well.
I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should have it on here.
Yeah, we should.
I think we should, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not next week, because I've got one planned, but we will do. But he goes into a lot more information about you, things like the grandfather paradox, which yeah. I mentioned before, which is the best example is you go back and kill Hitler, but that makes absolutely no
yeah.
sense.
Yeah. Is that also the one where you can be your own grandfather?
Yeah, yeah Futurama.
Yeah.
Or Futurama, Red Dwarf, yeah.
Futurama, yeah. actually, some very good hard sci-fi concepts yeah. in Futurama.
Yeah. That's in Red Dwarf as well, where yep. Craig Charles's character, which is Lister, Dave Lister, uh-huh. he learns he's his own father in a very similar way. He's never seen The Butterfly Effect, but he is keen to, because yeah. I explained the plot to him, yeah. and he thought it was great.
Yeah.
But it's kind of good fun. I thought the fact that he thought Flight of the Navigator was that served it best, yeah. I thought it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I'd sort of forgotten about the... It's more like a time dilation sort of thing
yeah.
for the Navigator as opposed to time travel.
It is. It's, yeah. it's not necessarily time travel because they travel to the nearest star, which is 4 light years away.
Yeah.
And they do that at the speed of light.
Yeah.
So it takes a lot less time yeah. traveling than it does on Earth, which yeah. is why he's younger when they get back
yeah.
there.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of cool.
Which is mined for some nice sort of pathos. And
he also did tell me that the parallel universe theory
yeah.
of time travel, which is used in things like Back to the Future uh-huh. 2, was invented by the father of the lead singer of the Eels.
Wow.
Yeah.
Don Henley's father.
Eels, not Eagles.
Oh, yeah.
My pronunciation. Yeah, Mark Oliver Everett's father.
Okay.
He proposed the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Oh, wow. I like the Eels as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, oh, cool. And, you know, Back to the Future 2 is actually a very... Just the number of sort of plates it has spinning...
Yeah.
...has got to be a
There's a lot going on. It was on telly last week and I watched it again. It's great. Damn it, still really good.
But, I mean, I always... And we've talked about this before. For me, the mark of a great screenwriter, if you're working, I guess, in genre stuff, mm. but is to be able to come up with a really cracking... The logic all holds up.
Oh, totally.
...time travel film. You know, I'd love to... be able to do yeah. something like that.
I think where time travel movies fall down is they take it too seriously and they yeah. try and explain the rules.
Yeah.
And Looper fails. They have that scene in the coffee shop where they explain the rules of time travel. Yeah. And it's all very po-faced.
Yeah.
Whereas Bill and Ted's, they don't take it seriously and yeah. therefore you don't care so much. It kind of works.
Yeah.
Same with Back to the Future. There's massive plot holes
yeah.
as far as that time travel logic goes.
Uh-huh.
The main one being is, of course...
His hand fading a bit. When,
there's that. Yeah. But even more basic stuff is, if Biff has tried to rape your wife, would you still have him around?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
You go, Biff.
Yeah.
You wouldn't.
Oh, Biff, yeah, yeah.
But they go to great lengths to explain that, you know, this is the point we set off from and now the future
yeah,
has changed.
Yeah, yeah.
They use that logic, but at the beginning of the film, Marty and Jennifer in 1985 have disappeared.
Yeah.
Because they've disappeared in a time machine.
Yeah.
So if you follow that line, they're not going to be in the future.
No, no.
But they end up meeting themselves. They wouldn't be there. They'd have been reported missing.
Yeah. How long have they been gone for?
30 years.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they turned up in 2015 yeah. and they would have been missing for 30 years.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So using that parallel universe theory, it doesn't work.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
It's getting quite deep now, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I never thought of that before. Mm. Yeah, you're right.
So there's loads of stuff like that in there, but they get away with it by being fun, by Michael J. Fox... bouncing in and out of every scene and just being fabulous.
Yeah, the spirit of the movie has a lot of papers over a lot of cracks.
Absolutely, these things. Yeah. Most definitely.
Yeah.
I noticed we haven't mentioned About Time.
Oh, God, I watched it a few weeks ago. It was on the telly. It's
fucking awful, isn't it?
Jesus, I wanted to like it, though. You know, like, in the first... Because I watched it with my girlfriend, and the first sort of... she really quite liked it at the start, you know,
because
it was... Domhnall's quite likable.
It's a bit quirky.
And But there's just no... Every time you think there's going to be a bit of jeopardy or, like, a real problem, it doesn't have the balls to go there.
No.
And, you know, like when he travelled back and then he comes back and he's got a different child.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just sorted out instantly.
Yeah. A mixed-race child can't have that.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So they paper over that straight away.
And you kind of think, oh, is he going to cheat on his wife or is da-da-da-da? And nothing bad actually happens other than he comes to terms with the fact that his father is dying.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's the whole film. That,
absolutely, and I did cry at the end because the whole scenes with him and his father, that'll get me, of course it will.
Yeah.
But the whole premise, again, it's very much like Groundhog Day. It's just him tricking a woman to sleep with him.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
That's what it's about.
Yeah. He doesn't really do anything really, other than trying to manipulate the love of his life into marrying him. He doesn't do anything good with his powers, does he? No, none of them do. So, yeah, it was
It's not very good.
So, what's our next one?
Our next one is, I have chosen a film from one of Hollywood's greatest ever directors, John Huston.
Ooh.
Yeah, starring Michael Caine.
Ho!
It's not the man who would be. I have chosen, big fan favorite of this one, Escape to Victory.
Yay!
Yeah, the 1981 prisoner of war football escape drama.
And the only movie we'd ever see Sylvester Stallone playing footy as a goalie.
Yes.
Was he the goalie? He was the goalie.
He was the keeper, yeah. So that's something that I saw, again, in the movies as soon as it came out, because I was a huge fan of football in the late 70s and early 80s. That was my era for football, so it was a must-see. And it was a cinema full of children, and there was a lot of cheering, a lot of screaming, a lot of booing going on, and I thought it was wonderful.
I have also seen this many times as a child. I used to watch this. One of my best friends when I was a kid grew up with a massive soccer playing family. His grandfather's Scottish immigrant to New Zealand. He played for New Zealand.
Oh wow!
And it was just one of those ones that every sort of Sunday morning after I'd stayed the night there, you know, would have sort of brekkie and put that on, and fantastic. It's like the Great Escape, but instead of escaping, they play soccer.
They do indeed, so I'm really, really looking forward to this one. Not seen it for many, many, many years.
Yeah,
so fantastic. I'm very, very excited. For our listeners, if you wanted to join in and watch it beforehand, in most corners of the globe, particularly on iTunes and Netflix, it's just called Victory. But in the UK, it was called Escape to Victory. So if you're seeking it out, that's what you need to look for.
It's called Victory on Netflix, and it's got this really awkward poster where...
It's them sticking their hands in the air, isn't it?
Yeah, you'd think it was about sort of camp cheerleading boys. They're sort of all sticking their hands out in a big V. or like a village people by a...
Yeah, they're doing the Y, aren't they? Yeah.
excellent choice. Yep. Looking forward to that.
Very, very excited about that. So
brilliant.
Awesome. I think we're just about done.
Yeah.
If you would like to subscribe, do so.
Rate us as well on iTunes, because I think we've only been rated by Chris. We don't actually have enough ratings to even have an average rating.
It hasn't made us easier to find on iTunes, because I already know how to find us on iTunes.
Yeah.
But if you want to do all that, please do. Find us on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Yeah, on Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
Yeah, Facebook, StillAnyGood. And if you want to email us, as Colin did, thanks Colin, StillAnyGood@gmail.com.
Thank you.
And we will see you very, very soon.
Be excellent to each other.
Party on, dudes. Sydney, the science got football.